Good. Good afternoon. I'm Humphrey Taylor from the Harris Poll. That's my day job. But I'm here today wearing another hat as a member of the board of the Alliance for Health Reform. I'm pinch-hitting for Ed Howard, who is traveling somewhere, and in desperation he turned to me and said, "Would I do this?" I'm delighted to be here, and I want to welcome all of you on behalf of the Alliance and on behalf of Senators Rockefeller and Collins to a program on developing and implementing health information technologies in select countries abroad and here in the U.S. I should warn you that I carry some personal baggage. I have 13 doctors in my family, seven of whom are still practicing in three different countries. We will look at the investment made under ARRA, the 2009 American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, and the work done by HHS and the Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology to issue regulations and develop standards for meaningful use of health information technology. We will also learn about investments and progress made in three other countries, Denmark, New Zealand, and Sweden. We will look at what is unique in each country and look at their special challenges and anything that's relevant from what they have learned which would be helpful to us here in the United States. How, for example, we can persuade doctors and hospitals to actually use health information technology. Our partner in sponsoring today's briefing is the Commonwealth Fund, and the fund has been a leader in promoting high quality and more efficiently delivered care. And today, from the Commonwealth Fund, is my very good friend Robin Osborne. She is the director of the fund's international program in health policy and practice, and the Commonwealth Fund have done a lot of wonderful things in the international arena over the last few years. She runs the annual International Symposium on Health Policy, attended by health ministers from many countries. A more complete bio of Robin and indeed all of our other guests is in your folder. Robin will be sharing the moderator duties with me today, and I should warn all of our speakers that when I'm a moderator, my main job, I've discovered, is to actually be a terminator so that they actually finish on time. I want to say a couple more words about the fund in a moment, but before we get to the program, I should say to you very quickly that you'll find a lot of terrific information in your packets, including the speaker's slides and biographical information and so on. There are microphones that you can use in what I hope will be a longish Q&A session, both at the front here and at the back, I'm told. They're here somewhere? Yeah, okay. Also, I should tell you that the webcast and the podcast of this briefing will be available on Monday on the Kaiser Family Foundation website, which is kff.org. And in a few days, you can look at the transcript on our website, allhealth.org. As usual, I've lost my third page. That's a good start. Let me just, if I may, before I turn this over to Robin, and I'll come back to introduce each of the speakers later on, but let me just say that, you know, I came to this country more than 30 years ago, and I was very disappointed when I came here to find that almost nobody in the United States knew anything about any healthcare system outside the United States, and most of what they knew was actually wrong. I have been absolutely thrilled to work with the Commonwealth Fund for many years now, doing cross-national studies every year, comparing different aspects of different healthcare systems around the world. And thanks to the work that Robin and the Fund have done, a lot of people in this country who knew very, very little about healthcare systems around the world now know a great deal more. Not enough, but a great deal more. So, Robin, thank you very, very much for that. And is there anything else I've got to say? Oh, yes, there is a blue evaluation form in your package, and I'll try to remind you later, but I hope you'll fill it in and tell us how awful we all were at the end of the program. Thank you. Robin.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Humphrey, for the very generous introduction. I know that I'm speaking on behalf of Karen Davis, president of the fund, when I say how pleased we are to be able to co-sponsor today's forum and bring together such a distinguished panel of international experts with leading health policy thinkers here in the United States. I want to, of course, thank the Alliance for Health Reform and Rachel Newsom, Assistant Vice President of the Commonwealth Fund, for organizing today's session under their very successful and productive briefing series. And I especially want to acknowledge Dr. David Blumenthal, under whose leadership the Office of the National Coordinator for HIT is taking us forward in the U.S. under a very sweeping historic mandate with unprecedented investment in health information technology. They have a very ambitious program that's been put forward that's key to transforming the U.S. healthcare system and to achieving a high-performing healthcare system. Just a few words about the Commonwealth Fund, who many of you already know about. We were established in 1918. We're a private foundation. Our mission is to promote a high-performing healthcare system that achieves better access, improved quality, and greater efficiency. And recognizing that many of the issues that we're most passionate about are of equal concern and resonate with policymakers in across industrialized countries, the fund established an international program in health policy and practice. And as part of that, since 1998, we have supported international health policy surveys, which we have the privilege of conducting with Humphrey's team at Harris Interactive. And what we try and do with the international comparative work is to show through the cross-national surveys, other comparative research, to try and benchmark the U.S. healthcare system and systems across the world to understand what is best practice, what's achievable, and through exchanges such as today to share country policy experiences, highlight innovations, and identify where country approaches may offer lessons to be learned. To set the stage for this afternoon's program, I just want to share a few slides of cross-national data that may be helpful in placing the U.S. agenda for HIT in an international context. In 2009, we surveyed over 10,000 primary care doctors. Here you see 10 countries represented, and asked about their basic electronic medical record capacity. And there was a really striking spread across countries in the adoption of EMRs. They're nearly universal in primary care in the Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, the UK, Australia, and Sweden. And as you can see, the US and Canada lag behind. Regrettably, Denmark, which is probably the leading country in terms of the breadth of HIT functionality, is not in this survey. Turning to some other data, and this is published by Dennis Prati, University of Victoria, you can see that many countries were early adopters of EMRs, and the enablers that drove that adoption varied. There's no one reason why countries have a high degree of IT use. Government funding and support played some role, although the amount of financial assistance varied greatly from Sweden, where the counties pay for everything, to Australia, where there are very modest one-time incentives of $10,000 to help doctors install computers and software in their offices. The Dutch government provided a per capita fee going back to 1991 for patients in private practices where the GP used a computer with some meaningful use criteria met. Electronic billing was a factor in some countries. Professional colleges and medical associations played a key role in others. In the Netherlands, for example, the Dutch College of Physicians took the lead on recommending the basic electronic medical record capacity that was needed in promoting standards. Accreditation of vendor systems, availability of technical support were all additional factors that came into play in most of the countries. Some further data published by Dennis Prati shows that when surveyed and asked about the benefits of using electronic medical record, GPs ranked as highest, most important, the potential to save them time. And particularly you can see the use of EMRs for refill prescriptions stands out. Exchange of data, use of data for clinical research, access to clinical data online were lower priorities. Going back to the fund survey, to get a sense of where the U.S. stands on use of electronic medical records in primary care, we asked doctors about certain routine functions that are central to patient care. And as you can see, there's a pretty wide range across countries of electronic capacity. With the exception of ordering lab tests electronically, the U.S., however, lags significantly behind Australia, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Sweden, the U.K., where the vast majority of doctors, 90% or so, have electronic access to patient test results, do electronic prescribing for medicines, get electronic alerts for potential drug interactions, do electronic entry of clinical notes. Asking doctors about their capacity in their office, the electronic capacity they have to generate information that's important for managing patients, particularly those with complex chronic conditions, and for managing a panel of patients, which is key to being able to deliver high-quality care for a population. We can see that, for example, virtually all doctors in Australia, New Zealand, and the UK can generate lists of their patients by diagnosis. They can list their patients by lab result to capture those with abnormal or poorly managed conditions. They can identify patients overdue for tests or preventive care. And they can list all the medications that a patient is taking, including those prescribed by other providers. And at this point in time, the majority of U.S. doctors don't have that same capacity. Doctors in New Zealand, Australia, the UK, and the Netherlands are four times as likely as those in the US to be able to generate reminders for preventive care. Doctors in New Zealand, Australia, and the UK are twice as likely to report that they routinely track lab results until the clinician gets them. And they're 2 to 3 times as likely as U.S. doctors to say they get electronic prompts to alert patients to those test results. When we survey patients, what we find out is that U.S. patients are the most likely to say they experienced a medical error relating to laboratory diagnostic tests, either given incorrect test results or they experienced a delay in getting an abnormal test result. What we can also see, looking across some of the findings in the survey, is that IT capacity that we've seen also tracks to GP practice capacity to address adverse events. For example, 1 in 2 UK doctors said they had a process that worked well for identifying adverse events and taking action. That's followed by Sweden, Australia, and New Zealand. Just quickly turning to patients and some of the issues that concern them, in our 2008 survey of chronically ill patients in 8 countries, and this data did not include Sweden, we asked whether they could make an appointment online with their doctor or get access to their medical record online. And as you can see, at most 1 in 10 said yes to either question. Putting together 14 different functions that GPs told us about in their practices, we created a composite variable of functionality with those practices saying that they had 9 out of 14 and called those high-functioning practices, electronic prescribing, ordering of tests electronically, generating lists of patients by design. And again, as you can see, New Zealand, Australia, UK, followed by the Netherlands and Sweden, had the highest functioning capacity. Finished last one? So just last slide. just to show you that this, nonetheless, is a really rapidly moving field. It's a work, HRT is a work in progress. It's a moving target in the U.S. If you look between 2006 and 2009, you can see that there's been really fairly dramatic progress made in the U.S. and with the agenda that has been put forward by the Office of the National Coordinator for HIT, we're going to see that accelerate. And in 2 or 3 years, next time we do this survey, the U.S. is going to, its position is going to be quite different, I'm sure, than it is already. So thank you very much, and I look forward to hearing from our international experts.
Thank you, Robin. I'm going to make the introductions very, very brief. We've got a very full program. First, we're going to hear from David Blumenthal, who I'm sure many of you know. He is, I think, commonly described as the HIT czar. Is that still a common phrase? You have his biography, so I'm not going to read that. I would say, however, something that's not in his biography. I've known David for many years, and he's one of the smartest, brightest, nicest, best people I've ever worked with and ever known. David? Where are you? Here.
You're exempted from the electronic health record requirements. thank you, Humphrey, and it's a pleasure to be here. I've worked with Humphrey Taylor and Harris. I've worked with the Commonwealth Fund. I've worked with the Alliance for decades, and they are all wonderful partners in many, many aspects of the nation's health policy making. So it's a great privilege to be here. I am going to be very brief, describe in 7 minutes the work of the national coordinator, and can't avoid also talking about a lot of work that the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services does as a major ally and partner in the HITECH Act. There are many problems that we have to overcome in the United States to get to the kinds of numbers that you saw with respect to adoption and functionality of health information systems in our sister countries in Europe. There are at least four that are critical. The first is financial. We lack both the funding to adopt electronic health systems and the systems that reward the healthcare, the financing systems that reward the higher performance that we expect to see with electronic health systems. So there is a real market failure that needs to be overcome. So that's problem number one. The second problem is a logistical or technical problem, and that is that we have many, many physicians and hospitals and other healthcare workers in the United States who are interested at some level in using electronic health systems, but they are fearful about buying the wrong one. If they buy it, they're fearful that they won't implement it properly. If they implement it successfully, they fear it'll be out of date before very long. And they're also afraid that it's going to break down when their waiting room is full. And all of that is very intimidating. So there's a sort of technical and logistical problem. A third problem, and I guess you're going to advance slides. Is that, or am I going to? I see. That's what this is for. This is a very sophisticated piece of technology here. So the fourth problem is that the third problem is that we don't have the infrastructure for health information exchange. And the fourth problem is that the American people need to be convinced that the information that may be managed in electronic form will be private and secure. Now, I was fortunate when I got here 18 months ago that the Congress had passed a really visionary piece of legislation that systematically addressed each of those to some degree and to some of them really quite systematically. So the HITECH Act, which is part of the 2009 stimulus bill, took on the financial problem through allocating money and instituting market reforms. It took on the problem of logistical and technical assistance through a system of regional extension centers that we have had the opportunity to create. It took on the issue of health information exchange through multiple interventions that I'll describe. And it also updated and laid the groundwork for further extensions of privacy and security requirements. So what about the what were the financial provisions? The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services was tasked with developing regulations to incent providers and compensate providers for becoming meaningful users of electronic health systems. $44,000 in potentially excess extra Medicare payments, almost $64,000 in extra Medicaid payments for becoming a meaningful user, and hospitals $2 million in an upfront bonus payment plus extra payments per discharge under the Medicare system. So that was an attempt not just to cover the cost of adoption, but also, in fact, to create a new market for the meaningful use of electronic equipment, not just the use, but the meaningful use, and also to create a market for innovation. And, in fact, there's been a huge entry of new vendors of electronic health systems into this market since the advent of meaningful use. The other thing that they did was they gave the Austin National Coordinator substantial funds to support the adoption of electronic health systems. So that was another important financial add-on. In terms of technical and logistical barriers, the Congress authorized and appropriated funds for specifically the creation of a national network of something called regional extension centers. These are on the ground, boots on the ground, shoulder to shoulder, elbow to elbow help for doctors, nurses, small hospitals that need that kind of help to overcome the barriers to adopting electronic health systems and using them in a meaningful way. Those organizations are dependent on available staff. There's a shortage of staff, so we are actually training in excess of 40,000 new health IT professionals. I had the privilege of seeing the first graduating class of these groups of folks at UT Austin last week. 58% of the graduating class had jobs. Many of the folks with comparable education in other fields did not. So I think we're creating jobs for the future with this particular program. The other thing that we are taking on and through the authorization and appropriation under the law is a system of health information exchange. One of the interesting things about health information exchange is that it's as much a social as it is a technical problem. In the United States, our healthcare systems are fiercely competitive at the local level. To get people to be willing to exchange information, you need leadership, you need governance, someone who can facilitate trust relationships at the local level. We also need, of course, technical solutions. The states are uniquely positioned to be able to provide a number of those things. So we've given states, all the states and territories, funds to create health IT leadership and governance within their local jurisdictions from the local level up to the state level, and that work is ongoing. We've also laid the groundwork for interoperability through adopting for the first time a set of standards for electronic health systems to enable them to communicate with one another. And we've also begun certifying electronic health records to make sure that they incorporate those standards. As of the beginning of last week, 45 electronic health records had been certified by the new certification mechanism we've created. This is 3 months in advance of January when the meaningful use opportunity begins, so there's an ample time for folks to find certified electronic health records. More records are coming on through every day, so I expect that number, 45, to continue to go up. And we're expecting to have more than the three certifying bodies that we've already authorized to begin certification very shortly. Privacy and security remains a big issue. The HITECH Act addressed a number of issues related to privacy and security. It tightened the penalties. It tightened the permission requirements for the use of electronic health information. It tasked my office, the Office of the National Coordinator, with working with advisory committees to create an additional framework, a more collaborative framework for health for privacy and security and for consent, for data segmentation, for a whole series of things that I think are going to be required to stabilize and maintain the trust in national electronic health systems. This is a framework that relates a whole series of these programs to one another. When we think about health systems in the United States or the HIT systems in the United States, we tend to talk about meaningful use because it's associated with lots of money. But the Office of the National Coordinator and the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services have really created a fairly elaborate framework that supports the adoption of electronic health systems, the exchange of health information, both of which support meaningful use, and both of which are supported by a series of grant programs, training programs, regulatory adoption of certification requirements and standards, the creation of new technologies for exchange, all of these working together to support the elements that I think will be needed in this country. We are trying to accomplish in a much shorter time frame than our sister countries used, trying to accomplish a sophisticated level of health information management using electronic technologies. We want to jump to high-value uses as fast as we can. Those high-value uses involve exchange of health information and the support of decision-making by clinicians using clinical decision support. If it would be nice to have 15 or 20 years to do this, we don't think we have that time. The meaningful use framework is really playing out over 5 years. So we are in a sprint to try to put in place the systems and the supports that are necessary to get what we think is possible to get out of advanced health information technology. You'll begin to see, I think, in the presentations from some of the colleague countries on the panel here, what's going to be possible, what we hope will become possible in the United States in a very brief period of time. Thanks for your attention. I apologize that I'm going to have to step out in about 20 minutes because I have to get a plane to Boston where I'm scheduled to give a talk at 4:30. I will stay for as long as I can. Thanks very much.
Thank you. In the interest of time, again, a very, very brief introduction for our next speaker, Thomas Bowden. He's probably also one of the smartest, nicest people I've ever met, but I don't know him well enough to say that. But he is the chief executive of HealthLink in New Zealand, he was the co-founder of the company HealthLink 17 years ago. And he has worked with 9,000 different healthcare organizations in terms of their use of health information technology. Thomas?
Thank you very much, and good afternoon, everybody. First, I'd like to thank Robin and the Commonwealth Fund for this enormous opportunity to join with you and for the work that the Commonwealth Fund does to spread knowledge and to enable parties like ourselves and colleagues from Denmark and Sweden to work together. Commenting in this paper on two areas, really. One is a bit about what we do in New Zealand, and then the second is to answer some specific questions that have been posed of me. As the slide says, I'm not an official government spokesperson. I head a private company that's accredited to provide health information and health integration services in New Zealand, one of several companies that does this. To give you some context, if New Zealand was a US state, this is about where we'd rank, right in the middle. In fact, it's very similar. I don't know, anybody in this room who's visited New Zealand put a hand up, please? Ah, right. Yeah, it's a respectable number. It's really, if you were in the main street of one of our cities, you could easily be in the main street of one of your cities. We all drive on another side of the other side of the road, but apart from that small and hazardous problem, it's very, very similar.
And you speak English.
So we're like a US state surrounded by water, just to give you an understanding of that. Key, I think, is that ours is an environment that works collaboratively. We characterize it, one of our key people has characterized it as a learning environment. Everybody is on the job. We've got vendors, government people, good industry associations, a lot of experimentation and debate. And if you ask in one sentence what makes us and our efforts different, is that everybody's working on the job. And I think that's really important. So our key aims as a group in summary, are very much supporting primary care. We had a major strategic change 15 years ago, which was to devolve as much activity as possible into organised primary care. It's effectively a commercial environment in which all of the parties are commercially provided and funded, much as the same in the US, but some of the funding is channeled through government, and it's all very much centred around utilising primary care. We're very interested in incremental change, building on what we do, and on creating trusted relationships so that we can get on with the job. And that's trusted relationships at all levels, including privacy and other areas. Now, I'm going to try and show you in this build-up of slides what's going on in New Zealand. We exchange 50 million secure electronic clinical messages annually, generally between general practices and all these other parties. All our practices have got a support system that enables it to get on with the job of seeing patients, and a lot of patients are being moved off into specialised chronic care services linked electronically to general practices. Some of the tools and things we're working on are high quality referrals and reports and discharge summaries between hospitals and general practices and specialists and all these other parties. The ordering of services such as prescribing, radiology, pathology, laboratory services, and also more recently patient connections to GPs. So we're building up a composite framework of all these different services that are coming on stream, linking parties. We're not big on centralised databases at all. In fact, nearly all of our communications is done between the providers providing information as is required. More recently, we've been focusing on the ability to go and get information, and one of the next things we'll be working on, or are working on, is enabling anyone to query on a GP system. So it's known where a patient is enrolled, and if someone needs information about their patient, they send an HL7 message as a structured query with an electronic signature. The recipient system says, yes, you can have that information, and sends it back. But this is still very much a work in progress. We've been working on it for 15 years, and I think we will be working on it for another 15. Here's a graph showing the number of electronic clinical messages. That arrow on the left-hand side shows where we got to 100% EMR adoption, and I think the main point it makes is that getting EMR adoption in place is really a baseline from which you can really start to do things. That spike is where we put in place one of our few national systems, which is a national child immunisation register done with relative ease. This here is a slide that shows the growth of electronic partners. I was staggered by this when I did it only a week ago to discover that the number of parties that our typical medical practice is now communicating with electronically is close to 60. Some, in fact, go over 100. And this, for the mathematically inclined, puts both of those together. I haven't a clue what it actually means, but it might mean something. This here is, to me, a very important slide. We've been using it for a long time. It emphasises the importance of building from the bottom up and getting everything right. We started with our clinical messaging, which is my company's focus, and we began with getting the pathology and radiology, getting a good understanding of HL7, getting in place the infrastructures and support systems, getting people on the job. And then as you go up the pyramid, the ease with which you do things and the value both increase. You can do really, really useful things, but it's very much, and I think building on what David Blumenthal has told us this morning, getting the fundamentals in place, enabling you to move quickly. So I've got a few questions that I've been asked views on. Incentives, I'm sorry about the slide. I'd hope that blue would be a lot brighter than that. The slide's asking the question about incentives, and my answer to that is, I think as long as they're aligned with the overall drivers, yes. Regulatory requirements, simple and clear-cut but light-handed. Vendor integration and certification, again, our view is yes, but keep it really straightforward so that it doesn't become an obstacle. Don't let people make it become an obstacle, because they will if you're not careful. And strategies for national standards, really important. We found that our emphasis from 1994, when we became one of the first HL7 affiliates as a country affiliates, has been really, really important. the role of a national health integrator, I was asked. Response is, my instinct is, why not let the market do that, opening it up to anyone who can chin the bar? Why not allow organisations who can deliver services to become accredited and get on with the job, rather than having a single provider or set of single appointed providers? Privacy and confidentiality, in our view, absolutely essential. It's a prerequisite to success in this space. And to really understand at a deep level the fundamental importance of privacy is one of the things that got us on our way. Public-private partnerships to support innovation? Well, sort of. We think public-private partnerships are a great way to get infrastructure done and built in a low-risk manner, but really innovation should be encouraged. And the more people working on the job of innovating, the better off everyone is. Our current focus is on online e-referrals. We're engaged in a system which will allow a set of hospitals to publish all of its referrals for the practices to be able to select any one of up to 100 referral types, automatically populate it, append lab results, digital photographs, and submit it online. And we're also looking at a system for creating emergency room access so that if someone information is needed about a patient, they can go straight to where that patient is seeing a general practice or multiple general practices and pull a structured set of information that can go into the hospital notes. So in the time that the is allowed, I think that's what I can cover. I'd be very pleased to answer any questions, and my email address is there. It's also on the program. Don't hesitate to drop me a line. And we'd love to see more of you down in New Zealand sometime. It's a great place, just like yours is. Thank you.
Good. Thank you, Tom. I'm actually going to interrupt the speakers because David has said that he would be happy to take a few questions before he leaves. And so if anybody has any questions for David, and I can't imagine you could possibly have any, please come to the microphones. And while you're doing that, David, what do you think is actually the most difficult challenge which you face in implementing your agenda over the next year? And let me, by the way, say I withdraw all those nice things I said about David. The Alliance is a non-partisan organization, so I'm not allowed to say anything nice about anybody on either side of the political fence.
All right. My attitude has now shifted completely, Humphrey. So I think there are many hard things that we're tasked with doing. The project that we are undertaking is really not a technology project. It's a change management project. I think in the United States, given our political culture, our size, our decentralization, I think the hardest thing we have to do is to create meaningful exchange of electronic health information. And the reason I say that is that exchange is fundamentally a team sport. The analogy I like to use is you can be the Eli Manning or the Tom Brady of the gridiron. You can have a great arm, but if there's no receiver down the field, your passing doesn't do you any good. And the same thing is true for the champion physician or nurse health informatician in a local community. You can be willing to send information and receive it, but if no one's willing or able to receive it or to send it, there's just you might as well hang up your cleats. So we have, given the competitive nature of our healthcare system in local markets, given the ingrained suspicion and skepticism that many providers have about their colleagues, given the pressure to maintain, to make money and to stay in business, getting people to trust one another and share information about their business, what they view as their business, it's a little bit like getting Toyota, GM, Ford, and Chrysler to share information about their customers. It doesn't happen naturally. And I think that's the hardest thing we have to do. And actually, the meaningful use framework, because we hope it will incent information exchange, is the beginning toward making information more marketable, more less toward reducing hesitance to exchange information. But I think long-term, we're going to have to find real incentives to build communities We're talking about community building here, not technology for health information exchange.
Thank you, David. We will take a first question from the back. Let me just have one very brief comment. At last year's International Health Symposium run by the Commonwealth Fund, the Minister of Health from Switzerland, who I think only said this because he was about to retire, said that if I want to get the attention of physicians, if I want a message to get to physicians, I write it on the back of a check. Question from the back.
I'm a physician. Actually, there are models for sharing information across hospitals and competitors. Pittsburgh Regional Health Initiative comes to mind, but that's not my question. My question actually is, how do you see the VA system, VISTA, integrating into your long-term plan or your short-term plans for information technology?
Well, VISTA is an open-source system that's available for purchase on the market. It's just pretty much free. It's available to be installed. It has not had great market traction, and I think that's there may be many reasons for that, but it is part of the it's an available product, it's an available tool, and I think that one of the problems may be that the it hasn't progressed, hasn't been maintained or upgraded to the level that some of the other vendor systems now are. The VA is now attending to that. They're planning to invest substantially in upgrading their system. It's still a great system, but it does need to be kept up to date. So I think that's one of the downsides that it's had.
Janet Lee, RWJ Health Policy Fellow. I have a question about the incentives that you can offer to ancillary services, in particular pharmacy and dental. And I'm thinking in particular of the use of pharmacies, national pharmacies, for the vaccination, the flu vaccination with the H1N1. And I'm also thinking about with dental, how do we get interoperability between those services, that medical patients who may need dental care prior to a transplant, what are we doing to incentivize there? Because in dental in particular, the same sort of Medicare, Medicaid incentives are not quite as applicable.
Well, dental services, there is a meaningful use opportunity for extra incentives for dentists under the Medicaid program, not under the Medicare program. And that's a statutory decision that the Congress made. So we don't have a policy for to incent either electronic systems of health information for dentistry or for pharmacy. It's also not an eligible provider under the Medicare and Medicaid statutes. So we don't have policies with respect to those. We nevertheless have plenty of work to do. So I hope that as time goes on, that the peer pressure and the opportunities to improve care will come to encircle the dental profession, as it will other excluded providers under the Medicare and Medicaid framework.
Hello, my name is Andrei Ostrovsky. I'm a medical student at Boston University. When you discuss health IT, it seems like there's a focus on EHRs, but what about expanding the scope of health IT to public health and using, you know, technology to integrate not just the medical care, but also public health and taking a systems approach to health? And also, is there a way to leverage the tools of social networking in EHRs or even beyond that to IT and public health in general?
Well, public health is very much on our mind. The meaningful use framework signals underlines public health uses of electronic health information. We are starting with electronic health records because, frankly, it's in hospitals and health professional practices that most health information now resides. And it's where we have to go to find that information, mobilize it, and make it accessible for all uses, both individual health care and population health care and public health care. So there are several objectives under the meaningful use framework that are public health related. They have to do with reporting immunization to state registries, reporting preventable reportable diseases. I think you will see as time goes on that the meaningful use framework will increasingly emphasize the management of high-cost chronic conditions that have major public health implications. As far as social networking, again, once we get information into electronic form so it can travel, so it's liquid, as they say, all kinds of uses will be possible. But we can't jump to those uses till we get that information digitized.
David, you've got time for one more? One very quick one.
Yes, one more.
Okay. Most of the people here, I think, are from Capitol Hill. What are the most important things that you need to be working with the Congress on, if anything?
Well, first let me say that I think the Congress, and I'm saying this out of true conviction, the Congress wrote terrific legislation in the form of the High-Tech Act, and there are some modest things that could be changed, but for the most part, I think what's needed right now is to let this law be implemented and let it proceed as it intended. There will be undoubtedly oversight. There should be oversight of what we're doing, but it's a very ambitious, very far-sighted piece of legislation, and I think what we would most value is the opportunity to implement it to our best ability.
Good. David, thank you very much. And as David is leaving and can't answer back, one of the interesting things is of all of the things that are on the healthcare agenda, health information technology enjoys, I think I'm right in saying, a great deal of bipartisan support. Some of you may remember a paper written by Bill Frist when he was leader of the Senate, a very eloquent piece about all the benefits which can flow from a good health information technology system. With that, we'll go back to our agenda. And the next speaker is Ib Johansen from Denmark. He is the deputy manager and consultant at an organization called MedCom, the Danish Center for Health Telematics. And again, you have all the details or some details of him here, so I'm not going to read those. Ib, what have you got to tell us?
It works, yes. Thank you very much for this introduction. I will tell a little bit about how we are using health IT in Denmark in what we could say in a meaningful use, but also as examples of how is it implemented and what is the outcome of it. It is not the first time I'm here in Washington. I have been here together with Robin Osborne before, and I have enjoyed it very much. It's such a beautiful city to come to, and even the weather is good. So I would say we are quite happy to be here. We have just a very few minutes about talking about this, and maybe you have heard about MedCom, and if not, you'll know a little bit about it afterwards. We are a public organization which is non-profit but financed from public funds, and with the purpose of making electronic communication in the health sector to give access to information for professionals and for citizens. I have this one slide here, and it says that for example, the prescriptions in Denmark from GPs to pharmacies, they are all made electronically, and 80% of them are transferred to pharmacies electronically. And you can choose among all the pharmacies in the country. It doesn't matter. All patients which have been admitted to a hospital, there will be a discharge summary which is sent electronically to the GP. And the same with laboratory reports and laboratory test orders, they are all electronic in Denmark. So we don't use paper. And all the GPs clinics, they have electronic health records or electronic medical records. It's the same in our country. We have referrals, and it's still some of the referrals are on paper, but we are working on it. And all the payment, which is very important for the general practitioners, it's of course also electronic claims. the whole sector, all hospitals, all private GPs, they have electronic health records, or in the hospitals, there are still some hospitals lacking for having a full electronic health record, but they have at least a hospital information systems. Some of the examples is, if we look at this one, if we look at the prescriptions, they are all electronic and they are stored in a national database where both the professionals and also the citizens, they have access to see the last 2 years' medication. So you can always see all the prescribed medicine. It is available there. And it is because all the DPs and all the pharmacies, they have computer systems. They have different computer systems, but they are interoperable using standards which Medcom have made and got them implemented. Another example is that all general practitioners, they offer email consultations and they can send emails to the patients. So 6% of all consultations by GPs in Denmark, they are through email. And the incentive was that the Minister of Health decided that they should have a little bit higher payment, the GPs, if they are offering email consultations instead of just having telephone consultations. So now it is widely accepted, it's fully acceptable, it's mandatory that all GPs, they offer this service. Another thing is we have a health portal where the patients can access the data from different sources. This is mine. I can see who is my DP, of course. And then I can see all the cases which I've had in the hospital. I can see my medication. I can see the different lab results. And here you can see a very important thing about privacy. And there you have to listen. You can see here. This is my medication profile. The medication I have got for over a period. And there is who have been looking at my data. All lookups of data, whatever it is, if it is a physician or if it is a nurse or if it is myself, it is locked. So the patient or the citizen can see who have been looking at my information. Very important thing. Another thing is, this is just an example of the different hospital cases. I have been in hospital several times, and I can see they have charged me two diagnosed related groups for the same disease. Okay, I think it was a mistake in the hospital. But nevertheless, I have a possibility to see that. I'm not using it for anything, but I can see that. It's quite satisfactory. And another thing which is important for patients, we can choose among all hospitals in Denmark, but we have to be put into a waiting list. This waiting list is open on the web, on the portal. I can see a specific disease, how long is the waiting time there. I can also see how many cases have they had for the last year, and the hospitals are ranked with 1 to 5 stars. So if I prefer to have the best hospital, and then I have to accept the longest waiting time. It's up to the patient. But it's full. It's totally open. Another thing is all the different IT systems. We have so many different IT systems, health information systems, electronic health records in the different hospitals. But there is a way of seeking out the data. They are showed on the portal of what we call the e-health record. And this is an extraction. We can see all the cases in all hospitals in Denmark. So if you are admitted to another hospital where you normally is not treated, they have access to look up at the data. It is a possibility you have, but it's not widely used. But it is a nice thing to have, we suppose. Another thing is, if you are having to be treated by a private specialist, maybe he wants to know more about your lab results. All lab test results is accessible through the health portal. They are normally sent to the GP who have ordered it, but it's also accessible through the health portal where you can see all the lab test results from all laboratories in the country. And you can see who have produced it, and you can see the normal range and the commons and all this. Another thing is, what is the outcome? Is it worth the money? It is just an example. We have a slightly raise in the number of consultations from the GPs, but we had a decrease in the number of general practitioners. And I claim that the raise in using electronic communication was part of it, that you could have more consultations with less physicians. So it helps at least. It helps at least something. I just skip that. Another thing is all referrals have to be electronic when it's to private specialists, but they are stored in a central server, what we call a referral hotel. And at this referral hotel, there will be a message back to the GP, now it is in a referral hotel, and the citizen can then contact whatever specialist he prefers. And he can have a look up at what is, how does this look, what is this referral on, and then he can have it transferred to his health system and start the treatment for the patient. And the patient, if they decide to go to another private specialist, they can do that, and the system will tell that now we have the patient moved to another one. Not who it is, but they just inform about that. We have another thing which is very important. All IT systems which are used in this health sector, they have to be approved, and so they are usable and they are handling the data in a correct manner. That's what we are doing in Medcom, and it's a mutual work with software vendors. But it's mandatory to be in the market in Denmark. You have to pass such certification. It's not difficult, but it is important. Another thing is that we plan about dissemination, so all the bad ones, they are red flagged, and all the good ones, they are green flagged. Just to follow that everybody is using and offering these facilities. We also offer test services, so for the software solution, the software vendors, they can test themselves before they are going to this certification process, so they can be prepared to it. And we offer this free of charge. Another thing, we have connectathons, like you have IHC. We have it once a year together with the software suppliers. We always do it abroad because then they will show up. If we do it in Denmark, they will not show up. So this is just 2 weeks ago, we went to Sicily and everybody was participating. Another thing is we do very much effort about having the things running. This is how we introduced test ordering for lab tests in Denmark. We started 3-4 years ago, and nothing happened for a long time. Then we employed a person in Medcom, which only tasked just have this running in full scale with all the users, and it was just the task to have been done. And after a couple of years or 3 years, then we reached 100%. So it's also just to make incentives, just to create incentives and look at the good things. No, sorry for that. I just skipped over all the different things in the meaningful paper, but we are fulfilling some of them at least. I would say what you call the core set, it is almost 95%, and for the other things we could learn lots of it still. We don't have a vaccination register in Denmark. We will have it in due 1 year, but that's some of the things which we have to work on. And then the big issues is patients' access to their own data, and it is self-treatment in the homes for the chronic disease patients. It's very important that we could move the treatment from the patients, from the hospitals and the GPs to self-maintaining the patients. And they are widely using this IT system for that. That's all. That was more than 5 minutes, I suppose.
Terrific. Thank you very much. Our third and last international speaker is Sabine Koch, and she is the first professor of health information at the Karolinska Institute, and for those of you who are not familiar with it, it's an amazing and extraordinary and wonderful institute in the whole medical field. Again, you have her biography, so I won't read it to you. Sabine, thank you for being here.
Thank you for the kind introduction. So I will present a little bit about the Swedish strategies, what has been done in Sweden, how are we going. And I'm, as a researcher, I'm not directly involved into the implementation, but I'm sometimes consulting national projects and following them, of course. So the Swedish healthcare system, we are a small country, 9 million inhabitants. We have 21 different regions or county councils and regions, and that's where most of the local implementation takes place. So it's a decentralized system. Then we have a lot of communities, which are more than 290, which are responsible for home health care, and that's a big issue for us also, because we want to have patients out of the hospital and treat them at home, especially elderly population, so that they stay at home as long as possible and we have care teams around them, which of course gives other requirements towards an informatics infrastructure. What we have done or what we are known for is that we have a broad introduction of electronic health records, 100% in primary care, 97% in the hospitals, and we also have electronic prescription up to 80%, and we have we have our quality registers. But what why the good introduction of electronic health records? That's because we had a lot of clinical champions, especially in primary care, and together with strong decision makers, they moved it forward. So it was kind of a bottom-up approach. They found it clinically useful to be able to document the quality of their treatments. There was, of course, peer influence, collegial pressure, so they were more and more adapting it. We had one thing which really eases up, that's the use of a master patient index or unique patient identifier. We have that as well for all the clinical professionals, so we can always match data from different registries or records. We have in Sweden a culture both that it is known as an innovative high-tech country, so people are not afraid of using techniques or technology, and they don't know of any physician, even if they sometimes they don't like the system they are using, and they see much things that could be improved in their specific EHR system. But if you ask them, would you like to turn back to paper, nobody would do ever. And I don't know any physician that does not use modern technology in his private life, for example. But then we have another part of this culture, and that's the culture of trust. We trust our healthcare system, and we trust that we will get good care, which makes the privacy issue a bit less demanding than what it is in the U.S. And from the beginning, we developed a lot with user centricity. So users were always involved. But that also resulted in too many different systems that we had. In 94, we had 27 different EHR products in these 21 county councils. So today, we have reduced to that main, for the four main vendors, they have 88% of the market. So, and regions are striving towards having one electronic record system within their county council, and thereby sharing the record information directly. Then the e-prescriptions, where we have 80% achieved, transferred fully electronically. This was because we had only one national provider of pharmacies. So they were, in the beginning, the driving factor to achieve this. But now we use this medication list, which is at the pharmacies. It's accessible for the doctors as well. And so you have a common medication list, even a more or a common prescription list, not a medication list. And then the medication lists, we have regional for each county council. They build up their own integrated medication list per patient, which they can share. And we're working on a national project to have a national medication list, which is on a national level and where then all the regions have access to, and that's implemented right now to avoid about 50%. Then we have the national quality registries, where we have more than 60 of those national. Then we have some local ones that report then further on to the national ones. And they were built up for the same reason as the EHRs, because clinicians wanted to have the information, and especially researchers, clinical researchers wanted to have the information. So it was the same, more or less the same reasons why they appeared. The problem is that we don't have an interoperability, and they are disease-specific, so now we're looking for more multi-diseased persons, and how can we connect the registers, the integration fully with the EHR is lacking. We have it only in some test cases, so you cannot get the data out of the EHR directly, but you insert it extra in the registries in which are web-based systems. So this connection is not there. Then we have most is done or has been done locally implemented, and then we have the national strategies which make the more the national infrastructures where the local regional infrastructures now are connecting to, and there we have several programs running, both regarding drugs and drug-drug interactions, national patient summaries, and also, of course, the technical infrastructure. What about meaningful use? The question is always for whom as well should this use be meaningful? So when we talk about meaningful use for Sweden, we would say it's that we try to support an information process or a system of information, not of single records. We want to have the information flow over organizational boundaries and to get the information at the point of need. So we don't look at single indicators for a record system, for example, but how do we handle the information such per patient to yield the optimal treatment. And we try to meet the needs of different stakeholders, which is the decision makers that want to have some kind of information in order to build up their incentives or whatever. Then you have the clinicians that want to have the right information to be able to make the right treatment. Then you have the patients who want to know other things. And in order to meet the needs of these different stakeholders, and to shape incentives for all of them, that's the problem we are targeting. And I think the next step for us is mainly to look into how can we get the data from the quality registers, compile it in order to have a proactive decision support for the clinician, and of course to integrate the information from the EHRs to the quality registers so that we have a whole flow in the system. But we are not there yet. And I think I skip the last slide probably because I'm running out of time.
Okay. Sabine, thank you very much. Okay, those of you with questions should please come to the microphones. And while you're doing that, I just would kick off a question which anybody on the panel is welcome to address, which is given that the United States is coming late to this, we can benefit perhaps from learning lessons from your countries in terms of things to avoid or things to focus on or mistakes that you've made that we shouldn't make. If you had one bit of advice to David, and we'll make sure he gets it, what would it be?
One thing to learn from Sweden is probably don't let all flowers bloom. So there has to be. But on the other hand, you have to have both. You have to have this top-down approach and the bottom-up, I think, because otherwise you don't shape the incentives, and it has to be the people using the systems that they really see why is it worth using, and I think that's something where we have achieved a lot. Yeah.
Thank you.
My answer would be to get everybody on the job. Don't keep the job to a small a group of centralized people, spread the effort far and wide and encourage as many people as you can give them a clear vision and get them on with it.
And mine is quite similar to Tom's. It just let the grassroots do the things, and the users, they should set what is going to be used and what is the benefits for them and what is needed for them. That's very important to look at that.
Good. Thank you. I think we'll start with the front microphone, if we may.
Okay. You guys, this is, I guess, for everybody. I hear a lot about the needs of the doctors. I'm sorry, I'm Kristen Bates with the National Partnership for Women and Families, about the needs of the doctors, and it seems like a lot of these are designed based on the needs of the doctors. I was wondering, or any of the clinicians, I was wondering if any of you spoke to patients or advocates or considered them as stakeholders whenever you were implementing your programs?
Did any of you do that?
Yeah, sure. We certainly do. But we do first and foremost see our role as improving the mechanics of healthcare delivery, and by enabling primary care to do the best job it can for patients is, I think, really showing benefits. Not necessarily very well measured, but very, very strong benefits to our health system as shown by various measures.
Good. I think we have one at the back, if we could, please.
Bob Rohr with BMJ. One point I disagree with a bit is that the U.S. is coming late to it. If you look at Kaiser Permanente, it has at least as sophisticated a system as the largest of the countries out there in terms of numbers of patients. But given that the three examples that we've heard today are from fairly small countries, I'd like to hear if those participants think there's any different set of issues or problems in scaling up things from, you know, several million to 9 million participants to a country of 300 plus million.
Okay. Yes, of course it's much easier to do it with 5 or 10 million people speaking the same language and having almost the same culture compared to a country with 300 million people. But again, you should look at what we are using. Most of it is invented here in the U.S., the HL7, the coding systems, the ATC codes for medicine. So it is also a way of how to uptake it and to decide why not try to do it, and let's see what happens instead of having everything solved from the very beginning. But of course it takes time, and if you saw the figures from Denmark, just for the prescriptions, it lasted 15 years from the very beginning until where we have got today. So it takes time.
I'd echo Ebe's comments about if you've got a lot of people on the job, you can get the job done faster, and scale, if it's all devolved, I think is less of an issue as long as it's well led, and I'm pretty confident it is. I think David Blumenthal's comments about health information exchange and the fostering trust amongst the parties as being the critical challenge is absolutely right. And as Ebe's just told us, in all the technology we're using, you know, Microsoft, Intel, Macintosh, HL7, the internet, the works, they all came from here.
Right here.
My name is Regina Holliday. I'm a national speaker on patients' rights and an artist who paints about healthcare. And I was very excited to hear what the gentleman from the Netherlands was saying about patient access to data. And I had questions about the other countries. What kind of patient access are utilizing a portal to get that information? And then what's the range and scope of that information? Are we talking about not just after-discharge summaries, e-prescribing, and labs, but also doctor's notes, medical reconciliation, nurse's progress notes? How far are you going?
Mm-hmm. We have a quite special situation in Sweden. We got a new patient data act for 2 years ago, and before that, patients were not allowed to see medical data. And that was because in the old data act, it was said that patients only have access, or only the persons that are involved in the treatment of a patient should have access to the data. And this was interpreted as a patient is not a treating person. So then we changed this patient data act, but we have not implemented systems according to it. So what we have now is a national portal where you can make you more administrative things like ordering prescription and or booking times and so on. And we have, with some patient organizations for some specific patient groups, there are also websites where you document into the medical record your own parts. And so we are thinking these ways, but we have not implemented it yet. Yeah.
And New Zealand?
In New Zealand, our emphasis being on primary care means that we are adopting a similar system to that at Kaiser, with a patient health record accessed from home, linked into the general practitioner's electronic medical record, electronic health record. It's very similar. We had a video conference the other day with Kaiser, and we're struck by the similarity of the systems. What we are keen on is a competitive environment where, because of using standards, different people can produce different patient health record systems that will connect to different GP systems and allow the interpretation of results, the booking of visits, the request for an additional extended prescription, all sorts of things like that. And we see that expanding into links to multiple websites, multiple utilities and tools, which can much more involve the patient in their records. But we don't have a national patient portal, and as far as I know, any plans to do anything like that.
I have a short comment.
Yeah, sure.
Just a comment for the how it works with the patient's access. Everybody, or many, were really against it in Denmark when we opened this access for the patients to see their own data. But what happened? We had a survey which showed that the patients, among 600 patients, 400 of them was looking at their own data. They needed no further interpretation, no further help from professionals to use the data. And so it was really, I would say, we could relax. There was no problems with that. So it's a good thing to take into account. Patients, they are not stupid.
Thank you. Before I come to the next question here, Robin, do you have a question you'd like to put to the panel?
Well, thanks so much. Dr. Blumenthal mentioned that one of the bits of infrastructure that we've developed here are the regional extension centers to provide support and technical assistance to the doctors as they're coming on board with electronic medical records. Can you talk about, in your countries, how you've provided technical assistance to physician practices, not just to get up and running with electronic medical records, but then to try and use them in more meaningful ways and expand their uses for quality of care?
Yes. Okay. In Denmark, we established an organization called Data Consultancy, which was helping in each region. There were three or four persons who were especially working on electronic health records for general practitioners, and they were helping them extracting data for quality purposes and learning them how to do it. That was one of the things. The other things, all the support is normally done by the software vendor. We train them free. And then if it is for communication issues, then Medcom have an unofficial hotline. They can just call us and see what happens then.
In our system, the effort is split between the GP networks. These are organizations set up by government but funded as part of the overall general practice funding. They provide a whole range of services, accounting and advisory services, really with the aim of assisting general practices to cope with the enormously big workload from fully devolved health services that they now have. The second area is from companies like my own, which is a health system integrator, and our role is to develop, implement, and support health information exchange services and similar services and security services. And then a third area is from the electronic medical records vendors. So while there's a bit of overlap, we somehow managed to make it work and provide these services. I think the key to it is that there's a lot of value in these services, so once you get them underway, there's plenty for everyone to do.
in Sweden we have not single practitioners, we have more larger primary care practices, and those belong to the county council, so it's the county council's IT departments giving the service, but we are talking about more educational structures nationally also that we need.
Good, thank you. Okay, we're back to the audience in the front here.
Front. Yep. Hi, Mike yep. Squires from Blueprint Healthcare IT and ehealthcaremarketing.com. Question about privacy and security. How, if you could make a comment on how you're handling that in your country, perhaps do you have a consent system which allows people to opt in or opt out, or what do you do and what could you suggest that we do?
Okay. We don't have much in the way of shared records. All the records are held by the individual parties. There's no large central databases. So that, I think, removes one reasonably high level of uncertainty. As a general rule, we have an agreement that with our people that their records will be exchanged for the betterment and improvement of their health care. And on very specific circumstances, we would seek their written permission to do so. But typically, because they know that the doctor they're dealing with is doing things for their health care, they don't have to keep asking permission. I guess you describe it as an opt-out system. But it has failed to become a major issue. People have just gotten on with it. We don't have health information privacy issues of any great type at all, very, very infrequently. It's again, maintaining trust is key. If you start with trust, a big bank balance full of trust, and you work on protecting it by not letting things go wrong, not taking risks that will allow things to go wrong, you can do a lot of good things.
Yeah, I think trust in government is a difference. Ib, you have a central database.
Yes, the way we handle this this privacy and security is for accessing specific data, we have a digital certificate. Each citizen, they can have a free digital certificate which they use for accessing health data. And to see the data there, it is only allowed to show data which have been accepted by the patient. So if the patient is not giving the consent distributing a summary from a discharge summary from a hospital, then they would be blocked. And you can block specific data, individual lab results or the whole record. It is possible. But normally it is not blocked very much. It's very infrequent that we see blocked data. But of course it is possible. And then if you, as a professional, look at patient's data on the portal, for example, you have to tick off that you have the patient's consent. And if you don't have that, the patient will have a letter from a written letter that this specific person has been looking at your data. And then we have a very strong data protection law. So if you roll out an IT system with individual patient data, then you have to have it approved by the Danish Data Protection Agency. And it also says that you are not allowed just to interconnect two different IT systems without having a permission for that. So and then we trust upon it. We have sent more than 400 million prescriptions in Denmark, and they are electronically, and there have been not one case regarding misuse of it. So it is working.
We also have a digital certificate for authentication, and we use the opt-out option, but in certain cases you ask the patient for specific consent, or if he gives not the consent for psychiatry records, for example, is a typical one. Then we have to implement consent management handling, which is not implemented really in all the different EHR systems. And the county councils now predict that they would need until 2011, some until 2012, to have it fully implemented according to what is required by our new Patient Data Act where it is ruled or regulated how to handle it.
Thank you.
And where you have an opt-out, it's not opting out of having data stored electronically, it's opting out of sharing the data,
is that right?
Yeah, okay, good. Actually, at the back, if we could.
Hello, my name is Laura Monroe from the George Washington University. I'm a graduate student in health administration and a recipient of the Health IT graduate grant. So my question is, part of this, in America, we're talking about health information technology transforming healthcare. So my question to the panel is, how has adopting health information technology in your countries of origin enhanced the quality of care provided and also reduced cost?
Great question. Mm-hmm. And who wants to answer that? I mean, I think here there is a consensus pretty much that health information technology will improve the quality of care, but there's much less consensus as to what it will do to the cost.
Well, we've noticed that the speed with which patients are sent to and gotten out of hospitals improved, the ability to implement public health programs for screening would otherwise be near impossible to implement, implementation of a child immunization database to combat a major meningococcal problem which attacked a large number of small children every winter, that's really been gotten on top of using the system. And anecdotally, whenever you speak to someone about their health, they are just very positive about how swiftly and adeptly their health care is handled. But we don't do enough study of it, and that's something we're starting to think about, but we're too much in action mode to really take a good look at what we are doing, really.
I think we have too few studies on that as well. One thing, or one example where you or physicians say that you really have a use, that is in getting access to the holistic picture of the patient, because you save so much time in not needing to phone, in not needing to contact any other physicians in order to get this data. And I think this spare in time and thereby money is one of the biggest achievements that I see directly.
Yeah, and actually Don Bowick and Bill Frist and others have written eloquently about how this should improve the quality of care, and maybe already has in places like the VA and Kaiser and other organizations which have pretty good IT systems. Yes.
No.
Do you want to comment?
Yeah, I would like to comment on it. We have seen several increases in the quality, the way we are treating diabetic patients regarding the different results which are collected from each individual clinic. They can see how can they improve the treatment of the patient so they get lower glycogen, the hemoglobin, and using fewer controls, but with more specific advice. Another example is that using this IT, you can say if it is an outcome of inequality, but because we have these electronic prescriptions, it is mandatory for pharmacists to dispense the cheapest generic. It's a law now, so there's no excuse for not doing it, because you have the actual prices of all the medicine in the market, and you have to offer the patients the cheapest one, even if the GP have prescribed a more expensive one. So you have to give the advice to the patients. You can have the more expensive one, but there's also another things in the market. So this is some of the spin-offs, at least.
And this mandatory switching, is that just to generics, or does that include therapeutic equivalents?
It's only generic.
Only generic.
Yes,
thank you.
But it was just to save money, and I think we have saved lots of money for medication just because of that. And it's a reality of when everything is computerized, you can have this spin-off from this for such things.
Yes, I'm Don Detmer, University of Virginia. Thank you all for coming, and congratulations on what you've accomplished. I'm curious about the unique personal health identifier came up from Sweden, and I'm curious where you feel you'd be if you did not have the unique personal health identifier as you move forward to build your system. Do you have a reflection on that?
I think, like Sweden, we also have a unique identifier in Denmark. We have had it since 1967. And in the beginning, it was a big rumor about it. No, we don't want anybody to know about it. Today, it is used for everything. And it, I would say it. We are lucky we have such one, because it's so much easier just to exchange information. And the only thing we need to have this is this strong data protection law. So if you don't have it, yes, good luck, I would say. It's difficult then to handle this. We have had to overcome so many difficulties just having this identifier. But we also use it for taxation, and you know that highest taxpayers in the world, I think it's Danish.
Yeah, we could say some more things about that.
Well, we implemented ours in 1993, and for quite a period it wasn't in widespread use, as it was coming on stream, people didn't know it was there. So we're still able to get on with the whole automation process without it, so don't let that hold you back, if that's the question. But now I think it is very useful to have it, because you can tie all the information together with absolute certainty, and as you get more sophisticated applications in place, it becomes really, really useful. I don't think it's an absolute prerequisite to have a national one or even a state one. It would be possible to have some kind of federated one via linking various systems, but some form of unique identifier is a very important thing.
Yeah, I can only agree, and we use it, as in Denmark, for everything. So I don't know Sweden without national identifier, so it's hard to say where they would be now.
We've had some really good card questions, so if I may, before I take the question at the back, one of the questions here is, in the US we have pockets of the country that do not have good access to broadband, and is that an issue in your country, or do you have universal broadband access, or does that matter?
Well, we've got pretty good access, but not as good as it could be all over the country. It's gradually is getting better. The more sophisticated applications that we are doing absolutely require a reliable broadband, not necessarily high-speed, super high-speed broadband. But there are still things you can do with electronic messaging. We've been operating since well before broadband, even before the internet, both of which are now pretty useful.
Yes, as in Denmark too, we have a widely broadband connections for the whole health sector for everybody. But what we have seen, all the new things we are trying, video conferencings and all these things, it is quite demanding. So we have to spend more money on having much more bandwidth in the broadband, more than 100 megabits. It's necessary for each individual GP clinics if we should have these things like good video conferencing facilities. Mm.
We have, of course, a good infrastructure in that sense, but I think if you're thinking text information or messaging for EHRs, then you probably don't need it as long as you don't take in all the images. But on the other hand, if you think remote areas where you would like to have some telemedical consultations, then of course it's essential that you have a good infrastructure for that.
Yeah, and I think actually all three of your countries have pretty high broadband penetration and still growing fast, I think.
Yeah, we have about...
Good. Well, another really interesting question on the cards. What about mental health records? Are they treated differently? Do they need additional safeguards?
Yeah, that's a big discussion, especially when it comes to consent handling, because that's the parts where the patients say, no, we don't want it to... this part of the record to be distributed, and that's always handled separately. Yeah.
Separately, yeah.
No, mental health records is handled in the same secure way as everything else, although I do note that speed with which development of systems and services for mental health has been at a slower pace, and I've put that down to the fact of people taking into consideration the specific issues around that sort of information.
In the same demo, we are not handling in a specific way, except for medication. Then you don't need to have the patient's consent if you are a physician, just to look at their medication. it's possible to do that. Otherwise, it's handled in the same way in, as all the information.
Yeah, one of the seven doctors still practicing in my family is a psychiatrist, and he seems to have a lot of patients who pay cash because they don't actually want any kind of paper trail about their treatment. We have a question at the back.
Yes, my name is Mary Tierney. I'm a researcher at the American Institutes for Research, and I'm also a pediatrician. So I've got a question about children and adolescents. What adaptations have you made, if any, with regard to the clinical records for children, given the growth and development issues? And really, that's it, but cognitive and mental development, not just the immunizations.
I did not understand the question.
Okay. I mean, kids are different, right? They grow, they develop. Mm. Do you have anything that you have done to take into consideration that children are not just little adults and that they grow, they develop? Have you made any adaptations for pediatrics and adolescents, for children and adolescents?
You mean
with regard to the electronic health records?
Yeah, we have special, because we have special primary care centers for pediatrics, so they have special types of records of EHRs. That's what they have. And when it comes to adolescents as users, for example, we have a web portal where they can ask questions about sex and different issues, which is specifically directed to this target group, where we also work with a panel of adolescents. They say, what are the, it's like a question answer service for them to meet via the net, because it's a little bit more anonymous.
If I can actually jump on that as well, which is moving from the young to the old, which is where I am, as you know, many older people have two or three or even four different chronic conditions, mm-hmm. all treated by different specialties, diabetes, arthritis, cardiovascular, whatever. And one of the many benefits of a good electronic medical record is it allows each and every person treating that patient to know about all the other specialists and all the treatments they're getting, mm-hmm. Which in the United States is actually quite rare. Mm-hmm. How are we doing? Yes, you want to comment?
Mm-hmm. I've worked a lot in this area of home health care, mobile home health care, where we share the information from not only different doctors or specialists, but also nurses, mobile staff coming in, social services coming in that also need some part of the information. And that's a very important area, I think, too, where you make a lot of benefits directly in giving them access to different parts of the information.
That's one area where we are seeing a lot of sharing of records, which is where people are encouraged to enroll in chronic health management systems where multiple parties can access and update records and give them really good care. And so we're actively encouraging clusters of people to get together on these programs. And it's quite hard to do, but it seems we're getting some pretty encouraging results.
Yes, it's the same in Denmark, that we focus on chronic patients because they are extremely expensive. And can we move some of the treatment to the patient's home or to the patient themselves, like home banking? Why not do it like that? So we are focusing on that for the coming years for the chronic patients, and of course many of the other things. But access to data for the patients, for the citizens, it is the key. And also the communication between the home care and the hospitals and the GPs, it's also a big issue.
Thank you. We are coming to the end of our time, but I'll take one more question from the back, please.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bob Rohr, BMJ. I wanted to follow up from the question from the last speaker at this microphone. In terms of adolescents and access to medical records and things, when is a minor person given access to their own records and the capacity to
prohibit or to keep things secret from their parents, things like this. Is there a continuum? Is there certain issues that change? How is that handled?
I think it's 15 years in Denmark. It's the law that says that you can only access it when you are 15 years.
I must say I don't know. I don't know exactly if there's an age limit.
I think that's a topic we'll be discussing quite a lot in coming years. But as personal health records is in its infancy for us, it's something that is just emerging as a discussion topic.
Good. With that, we're going to let you go back to do some work. Before you go, please fill in the blue evaluation score and make sure you give the moderator very high marks. Is that on here? Okay. Thank you very, very much indeed, and thank you for the panel.